goodbye. For tell somebody. Welcome to Tell Somebody and Happy May Day 2014. www.tellsomebody.us on Twitter at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail at tellsomebody.us. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the station or anybody else involved with it. The podcast of last week's show with Dr. Vandana Shiva's after-dinner comments in Overland Park, Kansas about cow dung and BS, and the remarks of peace activist Brian Terrell and former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, recorded recently at Whiteman Air Force Base, has been posted. Look for links at www.tellsomebody.us. An article in the New York Times, April 16, 2014, was headlined, "When Liking a Brand Online Voids the Right to Sue," by Stephanie Strom. Might downloading a 50-cent coupon for Cheerios cost you legal rights? General Mills has quietly added language to its website to alert consumers that they give up their right to sue the company if they download coupons, join it in online communities like Facebook, enter a company-sponsored sweepstakes or contest, or interact with it in a variety of other ways. In language added on Tuesday after the New York Times contacted it about the changes, General Mills seemed to go even further, suggesting that buying its products would bind consumers to those terms. "We've updated our privacy policy," the company wrote in a thin gray bar across the top of its homepage. "Please note, we also have new legal terms which require all disputes related to the purchase or use of any General Mills product or service to be resolved through binding arbitration." Close quote. New York Times, April 20th, 2014. "General Mills Reverses Itself on Consumers' Right to Sue," by Stephanie Strom. General Mills, one of the country's largest food companies, on Saturday night, and this would have been April 19th, announced in a stunning about-face that it was withdrawing its controversial plans to make consumers give up their right to sue it. In an email sent after 10 p.m. on Saturday, the company said that due to concerns that its plans to require consumers to agree to informal negotiation or arbitration had raised among the public, it was taking down the new terms it had posted on its website. A company spokesman wrote in the email that "we have reverted back to our prior legal terms, which contain no mention of arbitration." Close quote. On April 21st, I got an email from Public Citizen, consisting mainly of a statement by Christine Hines, their consumer and civil justice counsel, that said, in part, "Facing a public uproar that showed no sign of abating, General Mills dropped the unfair fine print it posted online that would deprive customers who used its website of the right to sue to settle a dispute." forced arbitration, which denies the people their right to sue when harmed, is spreading like a poison through industries that provide products and service to consumers, she goes on, and is increasingly being added to corporate contracts with employees. The only way we can combat this is if we, the people, speak up. Lesson number one from the General Mills fiasco for corporate lawyers and public relations spokespersons: Americans want to retain their legal rights. Thank you very much. Close quote. I got on the phone yesterday and reached public citizen attorney Christine Hines and recorded this conversation. Give a listen. I'm on the phone now with Christine Hines, a consumer advocate, attorney with Public Citizen. Christine Hines, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you very much.
I got an email from Public Citizen recently with the subject line, "Not just General Mills, dozens of corporations use unfair fine print to deny people their legal rights." What is this General Mills kerfuffle all about?
Oh, sure. So a few weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, the New York Times, a New York Times article uncovered some fine print on the terms of service on General Mills' website, where the company sought to restrict its customers' legal rights. So anyone who had any interactions with General Mills, used their coupons or any interactions online, used their coupons online, downloaded coupons or participated in sweepstakes, they would give up their right to sue the company, and they would be forced into a secret process to resolve disputes called arbitration. So, and that would apply to claims such as if a General Mills product, we know General Mills produces, for example, Cheerios and many other products, so if they were injured by the product in some way, they would not be able to go to court, but they would have to resolve the dispute in individual arbitration. That, and they also would not be able to participate in any class actions against General Mills. So it was a huge shocker, and it caused a public outrage for several days.
And do I understand General Mills backed down in the face of this outrage?
Right. So in the face of the outrage, the company issued a mea culpa somewhat, and they removed that fine print, that language of the forced arbitration clause and the class action ban from its terms of service on its website. So those terms no longer exist, because I think it found out that people would like to keep their legal rights when it's needed.
I was looking back through the archives of this show, and about 4 or 5 years ago, I covered Public Citizen, I think it was a telephone press conference, about the then upcoming Supreme Court case, AT&T versus Concepcion. And if I remember right, it was sort of characterized at that time that consumers had already lost the arbitration fight, and if this case went the wrong way, they would lose the class action fight as well. And I believe the case did go, quote unquote, the wrong way. Can you comment on that? Have I got this sense of this right? Or?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. So that case, AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, is what has given the corporations this tool to use arbitration clauses in the fine print of the contracts with their customers. And now with that Supreme Court decision, they're able to include bans on class action. So they are able to prohibit their customers or their employees, because it also happens with employers, that they are able to eliminate class actions against them, which means that companies can escape accountability. If claims can't go forward and claims of misconduct can't go forward, then the companies would get away with potential wrongdoing.
So have we already lost in the courts and now this is just a fight we're hoping to wield consumer outrage and public opinion against what the corporations can do if they want to, or have I got that wrong?
The General Mills example was definitely confirmed that consumers care about their legal rights. So the courts right now, the lower courts are very limited in what they can do in terms of preserving our rights because the Supreme Court has made this really drastic decision. So what we are relying on, what we really need is for a law. We need a law, a federal law by Congress that would eliminate forced arbitration clauses from consumer and employment contracts. And currently, two federal agencies have the authority to ban forced arbitration clauses in the contracts under their jurisdiction. So, for example, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is an agency that provides oversight over consumer financial services such as checking accounts and credit cards and banking and payday lending, that agency has the authority to eliminate forced arbitration from consumer financial services contracts. And we're hoping that that agency will make that decision to do so. For investors, the Securities and Exchange Commission, that agency has the authority to eliminate forced arbitration from broker-dealer contracts, so stockbroker contracts with their customers, because they also have arbitration clauses, and many of them have arbitration clauses in their contracts. So there are a few opportunities to eliminate it in certain places, but essentially we also need Congress to just pass a law to eliminate it from all consumer and employment contracts.
So just to be clear here, those cases involving financial services or stocks or whatever, the authority is there even in light of the Supreme Court rulings, AT&T versus Concepcion,
yeah,
and perhaps others.
Right. So in 2010, the Congress passed that financial reform law after that financial crisis, after our financial crisis of 08, and Congress passed the financial reform law, the Dodd-Frank Act, in 2010. And there are provisions in that act that specifically say that those two agencies have the ability to eliminate forced arbitration in consumer contracts under their jurisdictions. And the Supreme Court also, in its decisions, you know, even though they have permitted corporations to add these class action bans and to add the forced arbitration clauses in customer contracts, they've said it's up to Congress to change the law. And so it really is up to Congress to eliminate forced arbitration from consumer and employment contracts.
Okay, so this legislation wouldn't be already overturned by the court before it's even born, like some things might be in the face of, say, Citizens United.
Right. So this wouldn't be the same situation as Citizens United, where we actually might need a constitutional amendment. In this case, the Congress does have the right to change the federal law there. Supreme Court is relying on the Federal Arbitration Act, which is from 1925, a really obscure law, and they've really just expanded it out. And so Congress really does have the ability to amend that law to make it clear that law does not apply to consumer and employment contracts.
And what does the landscape of consumer and public awareness and activism, and the makeup of the Congress, do you see any hope for this happening anytime soon?
Well, we're always trying to talk to members of Congress to show them how bad things are for consumers right now in terms of the fact that they have no rights in these contracts. And, you know, we have some hope for these agencies to do the right thing, so we're also closely monitoring that. I think, the General Mills case again, I think it has really confirmed that the public is would like to keep their rights. The members of the public, consumers, employees, we would like to keep our rights so we can use those rights when we need them.
And I understand the General Mills thing. If you even liked them on Facebook, they were they thought before they backed down, this was enough in their mind to invoke these restrictions against lawsuits.
I'm not so sure about liking them on Facebook. The company has denied that would have been the case, that liking them on Facebook would mean that you give up your rights, because there is no contract there. You're not agreeing to anything there. But if, for example, a customer had downloaded a coupon and liked them on the company on Facebook, if the two were kind of entangled, if it was part of the same act, and the customer downloaded a coupon or participated with in a sweepstakes and liked them on Facebook, that would tie them to the terms of service and to the arbitration clause and class action ban.
Mm-hmm. This email I got this week or last from Public Citizen also mentioned a situation with Charles Schwab. Can you lay out what that was all about?
Sure. So Charles Schwab is a brokerage firm, so a well-known brokerage firm, and they have long had forced arbitration clauses in the customer contracts. So their customers get financial advice and other types of services. And other types of brokerage services. So after the Supreme Court decision, which was AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, given the companies the right to use the class action bans in the arbitration clauses, Charles Schwab sent a notice to its customers stating that it was including the class action ban with its arbitration clauses in its customer contracts, which caused a lot of people were upset about it. And also, there's an industry organization that oversees Charles Schwab, which permits customers to participate in class actions against brokerage firms. So despite the AT&T versus Concepcion decision, the industry regulatory organization, CONFINRA, which oversees Charles Schwab and other brokerage firms, FINRA does not allow class action bans in those customer contracts. So Schwab was in a dispute with FINRA, and then they finally settled last week. They announced a settlement last week where Schwab finally, they agreed that they would not use the class action bans in its arbitration clauses in the customer contracts.
Uh-huh.
Does that sound confusing?
Oh, a little, but we'll chew on that.
Okay, sorry. So I can try to restate it really briefly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just to make it more simple. So the Charles Schwab, it's a brokerage firm, provides financial advice and other types of financial service, security services to customers, to ordinary investors. And so, you know, a lot of ordinary investors will get like the light savings advice from Charles Schwab and other types of firms. And the company had included a class action ban in its forced arbitration clause. And then after the public got upset, Charles Schwab eliminated the class action ban last year, and then this year, and then last week, it formally agreed not to include the class action ban in the investor contract. So this was a good investor win that Charles Schwab agreed not to prohibit its investors from participating in class actions against it.
Okay, and this email we've been talking about also mentions something about Hyundai owner manuals directing that consumers' warranty disputes with auto manufacturer be resolved in arbitration instead of court. Hyundai also backed down, right?
Yes. So the New York Times, I think in December, wrote about Hyundai's manual. There was Hyundai tried to include an arbitration clause that would restrict its customers' ability to go to court. And the New York Times uncovered this, and as soon as the article was published, within hours, Hyundai contacted the reporter and said it was removing the arbitration clause from its customer manual. So that was another win for consumers, in that the Hyundai customers will be able to go to court if a dispute arises between Hyundai and the consumer.
And I think you and I and the listeners all know the answer to this question, but we've heard about AT&T, Hyundai, General Mills, Charles Schwab. Those aren't the only companies doing that, right?
No, there are so many more companies doing it. There are so many different industries. So I mentioned before financial services. It's in telecommunications with Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and others. It's also in consumer credit, such as, you know, Chase and Regions and Wells Fargo and American Express, student loans such as Sally Mae, and it's in online. You know, there are companies online that use it online, Netflix, Hulu. I mean, all of these companies have forced arbitration and class action bans. There are others, eBay as well. And, you know, they're hidden in the fine print. Most consumers are not aware of these provisions. That's why it's important that we, you know, let Congress know, let our members of Congress know that they have to pass a law to remove these arbitration clauses from these contracts. Because if something happens, if, for example, online, if there's a data breach and we are harmed financially, then these firms can send us into a secret process to resolve the dispute. It will be secret. No one will know about it. And other customers will probably suffer the same harm, so we can't help them. So it's all very unfair to consumers and employees.
And in court process, the losing side generally has the right of appeal up several levels. How does that work in a mandatory arbitration process?
Well, there's very little opportunity to appeal an arbitration. And after arbitration award, there's little opportunity to appeal it to a court. In fact, it's virtually impossible. So it's not only secret, no one will know about it, and if the arbitrator made a wrong decision in your opinion, then you likely cannot appeal it. It's nothing like the court system. It's all secret, and the company makes all the rules. They decide on the arbitration provider. They decide on many of the arbitration clauses, decide on the venue. So all of our rights are just basically removed when these arbitration clauses and class action bans are present in these consumer and employment contracts.
And as a consumer, if I go to arbitration with some big corporation, do I have any say over picking the arbitrator?
The arbitrator, well, it depends on what the rules are in the arbitration clause. But They would take the arbitration provider, such as the arbitration firm that would conduct the arbitration. That's the company picks that and includes that in the terms of service, typically. In terms of picking the arbitrator, it's possible that a customer or a consumer would be able to work with the arbitration provider and the corporation to pick an arbitrator. Mm-hmm. It's possible.
And in reading up on this quickly, one example that came to mind was contracts with a nursing home. And mm-hmm. I have experience of suddenly being confronted with placing someone in a nursing home without having time or opportunity to do a lot of research and without a lot of options. This somebody's being discharged from the hospital. They say, we're done with them. You got to put them wherever you can place them. There's not much consumer choice opportunity and not a state of mind and time frame to research this. Do you have any insight on forced arbitration in situations like that, and could this also be fixed by legislation?
Yes, you know, nurse, you raise a good point with nursing homes. It is, forced arbitration is very huge. It's a huge problem in nursing home contracts and in all of those documents, that pile of documents that a family would have to sign for their family member to be admitted into a nursing home. It's probable that an arbitration clause is in those documents, and it's a really harmful thing because there's so many, because nursing home residents can be, you know, subject to abuse. You know, there's just no recourse at all except for this private secret arbitration. There's no court recourse. You can't go to court if there is harm done to a family member in a nursing home. If an arbitration clause is in the nursing home contract. So that is a very significant problem, and the Arbitration Fairness Act, that bill in Congress, would solve that as well. There have been previous bills a few years back that would just, that would specifically remove arbitration clauses from nursing home contracts. So there, you know, members of Congress have been so alert to the nursing home issue that they sponsored a bill that would address the nursing home issue in particular, because it's such a significant problem. I know that even the states have, there was a West Virginia case a couple years ago where the West Virginia Supreme Court tried to protect its own West Virginia nursing home law, which banned arbitration. They tried to protect their West Virginia residents, even though the contract had an arbitration clause in it. That case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reversed the West Virginia Supreme Court. So the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the West Virginia Supreme Court, which tried to enforce its own law and to protect its residents from nursing home abuses. So this is a really, you're right that this is a very significant issue, and it's just one of the many problems with forced arbitration that's out there.
Earlier you mentioned, I believe, some legislation back in the 1920s regarding arbitration that I believe was originally just addressing business-to-business disputes. Have I got that right? And can you lay out some of the history of how we've gotten from where we were there to where we are today in terms of arbitration and class actions?
Sure. So the Federal Arbitration Act became law in 1925, and that law was passed to facilitate business-to-business arbitration because courts were unfriendly toward arbitration clauses generally. And so Congress passed this law to say businesses large businesses on the scene that have equal bargaining power should be able to enter into those provisions if they saw fit. So what's happened since then is that the Supreme Court has expanded the meaning of the Federal Arbitration Act to include what we call adhesion contracts. Those are non-negotiable contracts, such as, for example, with our cell phone contracts. Those, we have no say over what our cell phone contracts have, the terms of our cell phone contracts. We have no say over those. The Supreme Court says adhesion contracts may still contain arbitration clauses. It permitted arbitration clauses in investor contracts in the 1980s, and then all of that has culminated with Concepcion. There have been a line of cases which have culminated in Concepcion in 2011 and another decision in 2013 called American Express versus Italian Colors, which says even if you can prove that you can't afford to go to individual arbitration, it's too costly, it's not economically practical for you to go to individual arbitration and you need a class action so that everybody can share the costs, the court said that doesn't matter. You must still go to individual arbitration even if you can't enforce your rights under a federal law. You know, so you have civil rights, you know, there's a civil rights laws, employment laws, or antitrust laws. Those, all of those laws say you can sue to enforce your rights. And Supreme Court says if there's a arbitration clause and class action ban, too bad for your rights, essentially. You know, you can't, there's nothing you can do.
Uh-huh. And
so that's where we are now.
Yeah. And has some of this involved states' rights versus federal control?
Yeah, that's a great question. It does. So I mentioned the whole West Virginia issue, and which I think it's a states' rights issue because the Supreme Court has interpreted this Federal Arbitration Act to what we call preempt. It overrode the West Virginia state law. And Concepcion from 2011, that Federal Arbitration Act overruled or preempted a California law. California policy was that certain class action bans, most class action bans, were not allowed in arbitration clauses in these consumer contracts or in employment contracts either. So the Supreme Court said the Federal Arbitration Act would preempt California's rights, and there were at least 18 other states before Concepcion that had struck down class action bans. And those states, though their laws were also preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act. So these states who are trying to protect their residents are unable to do so because the Federal Arbitration Act overrides the states. That's why we need Congress to step in and say, okay, we're amending the Federal Arbitration Act to say that these arbitration clauses are not permissible in consumer contracts.
Mm-hmm. And One can picture, like a nursing home dispute or personal injury lawsuits or arbitration as involving large sums of money and restitution or damages in individual cases, and this could or might not relate to the class action aspect, but can you talk a bit about why class action is so important in cases involving smaller damages or sums?
Absolutely. So the Concepcion case is a good example of small dollar claims where we need class action. So in that case, it was the consumers. They were customers of AT&T, and they sought a class action against AT&T because they were AT&T added a $30 charge to purchase their phones, even though AT&T had advertised the phone as free. And so they alleged that that was a breach of contract and that it was a certain misconduct from AT&T for them to advertise one thing and do something else. There are other worse acts of companies, but that's a small dollar claim, and most of us, most consumers, most employees are not going to sue a company for $30, even though that company maybe would not have maybe that company should not have charged us that $30. We're not going to go to court over that. So the best, it's likely that that the company is charging other consumers that same $30. So the class action tool is a really efficient way to address the claims of all these people that the company is overcharging. So if you add up all the $30 over for all the consumers that could have been affected with this a wrongful charge, that's really millions of dollars in ill-gotten gains if that $30 was illegal, the $30 charge was illegal. So that's a lot of money that the company is getting from wrongful gains. So the company should have to give that money back. It should not get profit from wrongful charges to all the consumers. Anyway, the class action is the best way for these customers to seek recourse against corporations for those types of small dollar charges and small dollar injuries. It's the most efficient way to address those types of claims.
Hopping back from class action back to individual forced arbitration. There was even a fairly high-profile case involving rape and the forced arbitration by a company against the employee who had signed an employment contract, Kellogg, Brown & Root, then subsidiary of Halliburton. Are you familiar with that one?
So there was a case a few years back, which has since been resolved, over an employee who had these allegations against her co-workers for harming her. These were allegations, and there was an arbitration clause in her contract with her employer. And Halliburton is a defense contractor, and there was an arbitration clause in their contract, and she had claims against her employer, and she could not move forward with those claims. Senator Franken, Al Franken of Minnesota, he introduced an amendment to a defense bill, a bill in Congress. He introduced it that would eliminate forced arbitration for certain claims, such as certain civil rights claims, and for sexual assault for defense contractors. So, therefore, defense contractors had to remove their arbitration clauses to protect employees who had these types of claims, like if there was civil rights or a sexual assault claim, they would be able to go to court instead of go to secret arbitration. Because of this experience or of this story that came out, the senator was able to get a law passed that would eliminate arbitration clauses in those instances. So
that legislation did pass.
It's law, and it's part of a defense kind of defense funding law. Yes, the Department of Defense.
Okay.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, any other thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners? And if there hasn't been enough already, why they should be concerned about this and what they can do if they are concerned, and websites, sources for other information.
Sure. So I think that General Mills showed that consumers out there are very concerned about their rights. They get very outraged about the fact that these companies are inserting this fine print in all of their interactions with their customers. General Mills overstepped and had to backtrack, but there's so many other companies out there that have these arbitration clauses and ban class actions, and we have to, you know, contact our members of Congress to tell them to co-sponsor the Arbitration Fairness Act, to support the Arbitration Fairness Act, because we really need a law passed. We can't go to every single company and get them to backtrack like how we did with General Mills. We have to get a law passed to address all of the problems with all of these various industries. So it's a very huge project, and one day we'll get there, but we have to kind of band together to get Congress to do the right thing.
And the wording of this proposed legislation, if we just put Arbitration Fairness Act in a search engine, will that do it?
Oh, yes. The Arbitration Fairness Act, if you search it on Google, it would get there. And you can also go to www.citizen.org and put arbitration or search public citizen and arbitration. There will be a lot of information about forced arbitration and about the Arbitration Fairness Act. And there's also, we also have a mechanism where you can click on our website, and that would take you directly to your member of Congress there to email them to ask them to support the Arbitration Fairness Act. So if you go to our website, public citizen, and just search for arbitration, you'll come across all of that information.
Okay, and that's www.citizen.org, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, we've been talking to Christine Hines, consumer advocate and consumer and civil justice counsel with Public Citizen. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today on Tell Somebody.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. A quick note on the defense contracting arbitration legislation we just heard about. In a piece posted on the Huffington Post on March 18, 2010, under the headline, "Franken Gets His First Amendment Passed by Roll Call Vote," Sam Stein wrote, "After operating largely under the radar during his first few months in office, Senator L. Franken, D. Minnesota, is slowly beginning to make political ripples. On Tuesday night, the Minnesota Democrat got his first piece of legislation passed by the United States Senate via roll call vote. The amendment stopped federal funding for those defense contractors who use mandatory arbitration clauses to deny victims of assault the right to bring their case to court. It passed by a 68-30 margin. Franken's amendment was added to the fiscal year 2010 Defense Appropriations Bill. Move to Amend spokesman David Cobb spoke in Kansas City on April 22nd about the need to amend the U.S. Constitution to overturn the legal fiction of corporate personhood and do away with the strange idea pushed by a corrupt Supreme Court majority that money equals speech. Expect to hear Cobb's entire speech broadcast on KKFI in the near future, but I think in the time remaining, I'll play a bit of it right now. Give a listen.
Much. All right. You know, I can always tell that I am in the right crowd when my arrest record gets the applause. And I'm proud I've been to jail for justice. Because when I ran for president of the United States on the Green Party ticket, I ran on my arrest record. Right? So I want to ask, honestly, how many people here have been to jail for justice? How many of you have actually gone to jail for nonviolence? Can we get a round of applause for every hand that's coming up? And I ask for that because I want to start by telling you, you see, I take myself seriously. I take the people who raise their hand seriously, and I take you seriously. And by that I mean you, the person occupying the seat that you're sitting in. And I say that because I really want to ground something. I want to really anchor it. And that is this, that we are the people that we have been waiting for. That this is the moment, right? That there is a historic moment that's coming. And so tonight I stand before you. See, I don't think I have to convince you that things are bad. Right? Polling data shows the overwhelming majority of Americans actually know that things are bad. And the fact that you have chosen to come here, such a big crowd, I reckon that you probably already know that. See, I don't have to convince you of that. You know what I think I have to do? I think my job is to persuade you that Move to Amend has a plan to win. Right? That's my task. And so, since I want to be persuasive, I want to share with you something that I learned intuitively as a successful trial lawyer, and now scientists are proving, and that's this. If you want to be persuasive, facts don't really matter so much. Y'all, the first time I heard that, I thought, this is terrible. Right? Like many of you, I've invested a lot of time and energy in learning facts. And there's this idea that if you can just present facts logically, cogently, well, everybody will see what we see, and somehow change will happen. But then I came across the work of a fellow named George Lakoff. Some of you know it. George Lakoff, he's a cognitive scientist, and by studying how human beings process information, how we know what we know, he discovered that the human brain is not some sort of supercomputer collecting data, running algorithms, drawing conclusions. George Lakoff says human beings understand the world through the stories we tell each other. And the stories that are told over and over to us become the narrative or the frame, how we see the world. And so what Lakoff says is, of course, facts matter, but only if you present those facts in light of the existing narrative, in a way that makes sense to people. So, since I want to be persuasive, and because I know that human beings understand the world through stories, I'm fixing to tell a story. I'm going to tell the story on how it came to be that these large transnational corporations are not just exercising power. I'm fixing to tell the story on how it came to be that large transnational corporations are ruling us. As surely as masters once ruled slaves, as surely as kings once ruled subjects, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are ruling in this country. Because they're making the decisions. Corporate CEOs already decided how much poison is in the air that we're all breathing right now. Corporate CEOs have already decided how much toxins can be in the public water supply of Kansas City. Corporate CEOs are deciding whether you get health care or not. Doesn't matter whether you're sick or injured. Corporate CEOs decided to take this country into war. And we, the people, we get to choose between Coke or Pepsi. We can choose between paper or plastic at a grocery store checkout line. See, we have consumer choices, provided you have the money to pay. Let's just stop for a moment and acknowledge something, that in this society, human need is actually not what's driving the situation. It's only whether you can pay for it. But friends, even if you're blessed in this economy to be able to pay for consumer choices, don't mistake a consumer choice with the exercise of political power. You see, political power would be the opportunity to participate in a meaningful way with how our society is organized, right? That's what actual political power would look like. So I am going to tell a story. And as I tell the story, I want to challenge you to challenge me and ask, is this a story that only liberals and progressives can hear and appreciate? Or has Move to Amend figured out a way to tell this story in a way that cuts across political affiliations? Is this a story that can cut across even ideologies? Is this a story that can actually begin to unite us as a people? And as I tell the story, I'm going to make sure that we cover four topics together. I want to get this out where as many can see it. Right? So we're going to cover four topics in this story. The first topic we're going to make sure that we cover is the word democracy. That word gets tossed around a lot in this country, so let's make sure we've got some common ground. From what language does the word democracy derive?
Greek.
Very good. Demos means?
People.
The people. Kratia, K-R-A.
To rule.
To rule. Very good. So literally, the word democracy translated from Attic Greek means the people rule. Pop quiz. How many of y'all believe we the people are ruling in the United States? Don't be shy. Look around. I'm not there. Look around just real quick. We got a big crowd here tonight. Not a single one of you raised your hand. I do this presentation all across the country. I did it 150 times last year. This year I'm on track to do it more than that. Sometimes I do an afternoon and evening presentation. Everywhere I go, I ask that question. Almost nobody raises their hand anymore. See, I'm of a generation when there was an assumption made, myself included, that, yeah, the United States might have some problems, but we can fix them because we're a democracy. The people rule. We can figure it out. Friends, nobody's raising their hand to that question anymore. That's a problem. But saying it another way, I think it's a good thing. What? Oh, no, no. It's not a good thing that we, the people, are not ruling. It's a good thing that people aren't raising their hands to that question anymore. I think it's a good thing that we're being honest enough, and I'm going to say it, courageous enough to confront a very difficult, sobering reality. That notwithstanding the creation myth of this country, notwithstanding what we want, notwithstanding what we were taught as children, the United States of America is not now, nor has it ever actually been, a functioning democracy. And there's actually a scientific study out right now that actually proves that, right? The United States is not a democracy, we're an oligarchy. That means the rule by a small, wealthy elite. And some of my friends are like, you know what, you could have saved a bunch of trouble and just asked any working class person I know, and they'd have been able to tell you that answer, but now we got scientific data for it. That brings me to the next topic, which is sovereignty. Friends, if I just had the word the sovereign on the board, who or what would you think of? Quick, the sovereign, shout it out. King, I bet everybody here thought the king, right? That's because the word sovereignty means the authority to rule. And 500 years ago, the sovereign was the king. The king was the sovereign. Those words were literally synonymous. And where did the king claim his authority to rule? God. You don't get more legitimate. I mean, that's a big deal. In fact, to illustrate what we mean by this, we'll do a little exercise together. This exercise is always a lot of fun for me. You'll see, I'll invite you who are willing to do it, close your eyes and repeat after me. David Cobb is our king. That didn't go so well. I'll try another one. Because David is God's representative on this earth. Alright, last one. And therefore, anything David tells me to do, I will obey without question. Okay, well normally this is where I would say open your eyes, but to your credit, Kansas City, ain't nobody's eyes closed in this crowd. Good on you. But you didn't do what everybody does. As soon as you realized what I was asking you to do and say, you all laughed at me. Did you notice? Some of you snickered, right? But everybody kind of laughed. And you know why you laughed? Well, because it's funny. And not funny like, oh, what a witty comment funny. Funny like absurd funny. Like that's just stupid funny, right? The fact that I could tell you how to live your life because who my daddy is, or even better, I get to tell all of you what to do and, in fact, how society will be organized because of the divine right of kings. Of course you laughed at that. That's ridiculous. That's foolish. And 500 years ago, people just like you and you and you and me not only said it, but we believed it. Friends, I'm asking you to take a moment and consider that. This is very profound to me. And now the Texan go get metaphysical on y'all, so hold on. You ready? We are all participating in creating our shared collective reality. Another way to say that is, if enough people think that something is true, enough people act like it's true, it becomes true, right? So when people tell me, oh, you can't amend the Constitution, that's too hard. We'll never do that. I think, have you not been paying attention? Throughout all of world history, throughout U.S. history, profound changes have been made. And I don't mean just electing one president over another. I don't mean just electing one Congress over another. I mean changes in relations. I mean changes in power. I mean profound changes have been made, right? And you know what it took? For people to start to think and act differently. And so, if it's true that the United States of America is fundamentally racist, fundamentally sexist, and fundamentally class oppressive, and that is true. And if it is true that these huge transnational corporations are destroying the planet that we depend upon for life itself, and that is true. See, if these things are true, I suggest we ought to start thinking and acting differently than we have been. Maybe, yeah, right? maybe we ought to start thinking and acting like we're in a moment of crisis. You know why I think we ought to start thinking and acting like we're in a moment of crisis? Because we're in a moment of crisis, y'all. And look, it is true. It is an ecological crisis. It's not coming. It's here and going to get worse until we interrupt it. We are in an economic crisis. It's not coming. It's here and going to get worse until we interrupt it. In fact, if you think the housing crisis was bad, wait until this student debt crisis hits. And like, I got immense love and compassion for the students of this generation who are being saddled with a debt that most of us who are older cannot even begin to imagine. Oh, and by the way, I don't mean the harbinger of bad news, but there ain't no jobs. Right? Or very few of them. They're being outsourced, and the wealthy elite are sending them out. So it's an economic crisis. It's not coming, it's here. And it's a social justice crisis. How else can we describe a system where 20 to 25% of the children in the richest country the world has ever seen go to bed hungry at night? That's a crisis. How else can we describe a public education system which is basically being turned into a school-to-prison pipeline, targeting brown and black-skinned kids so that they can become commodities to be locked up so corporations can make money off of it? That's a social justice crisis. How else can we describe a healthcare system where instead of just getting access to healthcare as a fundamental human right, it is bought and paid for as if it were a commodity? And frankly, friends, there's a fourth crisis, and I want to thank some of the people that I work with who have given me the courage to say this out loud and get comfortable saying it. It's a spiritual crisis. It is a spiritual crisis because, and thank you for the people who applauded that, right? Because frankly, friends, what I know to be true, and the society had convinced me not to talk about it out loud, but I'm now being courageous enough to do it, that it is our birthright to be a connection to one another. We're supposed to be collaborating with one another. That's what the divine wants for us. That's what we were put here to do, and we were put here to be stewards of the earth and in partnership with life itself. Not just connection to our family, but to other human beings and other community. And when we do it right, to life itself in this amazing dance, right? That's what we deserve. That's our spiritual belief. That's what we should have, and it's been stolen from us. So we have a series of crises that are coming. But I don't want you to get over upset about that, because I want to remind you that in the Chinese language, where they use symbols for words, the symbol for crisis is also the symbol for another word.
Opportunity.
Friends, we are blessed and cursed to be human beings at this moment in world history. Because yes, we're in a series of crises, but these crises are providing us an opportunity to actually think about and talk about transformational change. Levels of change at the social, political, and economic system that most human beings before us might have dreamed about in their fondest hopes, it's within our grasp. And here's something else. If we don't do it, we're doomed. And I don't know how else to say it, but between all these crises that are coming, we've got to take advantage and make that kind of big change. And speaking of changes, that brings me to the next topic, which is the word legal personhood. Please note I did not write corporate personhood on the board. Right? That's because the very concept of legal personhood means the ability to assert rights. And since we're talking about legal personhood, we need the ability to assert rights under law. And saying it that way, I hope it's obvious to you, this is not a technicality that only lawyers should concern themselves with. The question of who has a legal right and can assert it under law and have the culture recognize it, that has been at the heart of every major movement of this country. From the creation of this country in the American Revolution itself, to the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage movement, the trade union movement, the civil rights movement, all of those movements, and notice I said movement, not policy issues, but actual social movements all understand the ability to assert rights under the legal system is at the core of what it takes to actually make change. And that brings me to the last topic, which is corporation. From what language does the word corporation derive?
Latin,
very good. Corpus means
body.
And the suffix T-I-O-N means to have or create. So literally, translated from Latin, The word corporation means to have or create body. And by body, I mean physical body, right? And that's because in law school we're taught. And by the way, are there any lawyers in the crowd besides me that would admit it? Got a couple of hands. Y'all raise your hands quick. Y'all must be people's lawyers. Right? People's lawyers can be proud. I got a power fist back there from the sister at the bar right there. Alright, so for my lawyers in the crowd, y'all remember this? A corporation is a legal fiction. Yep. See, I've never met a lawyer who doesn't remember that. And watch this. Even those of you who were not subjected to 3 years of law school, if you've heard the phrase that a corporation is a legal fiction, even if you can't precisely define it, but if you've just heard that a corporation is legal fiction, raise your hand. See, all those hands go up, right? So if a corporation is a legal fiction, that begs the question, what does the word fiction mean? Not true, made up. First day of corporations class, my law school professor stood before us and she said, you have to understand, a corporation does not actually exist in the material physical world. It's a legal fiction. And I thought to myself, the material physical world, isn't that reality? And she went on to say, you see, it's a construct. We're going to pretend like a whole group of people and the investments that they make and the resources that they gather and the contractual obligations that they make and the cultural assumptions around it, a very rich, complex concept. We're going to pretend like it's just one thing under law. And remember, if enough people think that something is true, enough people act like it's true, poof! A corporation is a construct, meaning it only exists if and when society at large agrees that it's going to exist. It is a concept. That is very key. And I bet our economics club would agree to that. A corporation, yep, she's getting thumbs up. A corporation comes into being that way. And get this. The first corporations ever created by the clever, creative genius mind was created during the Roman Republic. That's why the word corporation comes from Latin. And you see, the Romans created this concept for a reason. For example, how many of y'all have heard, or better yet, how many of you have said, all roads lead to Rome? Yes, it's 2,000 years later, we still say that phrase. Check it out. That road system, it was built and operated as a corporation. Likewise, the aqueduct system, that amazing bit of engineering that moved water all across the Italian peninsula without electricity. Can we just stop for a moment and say, one of the reasons that I maintain such, not just like, oh gosh, I hope things work out, but genuine optimism about what is possible, is because I know how creative and clever human beings are. In fact, I don't think you could probably name a problem that I can't give you the answer and the solution to if you give me about 30 minutes and access to the internet.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.